Hello and welcome to another news episode of BFRR, our Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock and Roll podcast. We explore the intersection of traditional finance, digital money and digital assets and help you understand how digital money and assets will evolve in the future. I am co-host Michael Blaschke, and today it is time for another news episode. Today we look back to the month of July and discuss what we deem the most relevant developments in the institutional DLT space. To this, I am joined by our longtime guest and friend Nadine Wilke, co-founder and chief growth officer at Particular. Welcome, Nadine.
Thank you for having me. Hi.
And we're also joined by our well-known co-host, Manuel Klein. Manu, good to have you here.
Good morning. Hello, both. Good to see you, Nadine.
So today we're gonna cover a brief market overview. We're gonna deep dive into stable coins, that is new issuers, banking access, and payments infrastructure. We're also gonna cover tokenization, institutional capital markets on DLT. We'll zoom into regulation policy and CBDCs and have a short section on the crypto ecosystem platforms and the corporate strategy on institutional DLT. All right, let's get into it.
Yeah, and as always, we start with a brief overview of the current market with the two favorite cryptocurrencies that obviously need to be talked about, which is Bitcoin and Ethereum. And July has been a relatively stable month for Bitcoin, trading around $63,000 to $65,000. A very tight band all the month, not a lot of volatility. And the latest price was around $65,000 as well. And with ETH, we see quite a bigger band, 1,500 to 1,900, but a higher volatility, especially also on some news that we've seen from the Ethereum Foundation to laying off roughly 20% of the staff. I think that was clearly also a price driver. So when it comes to comparing it to the maximum highs and the peaks, let's say, Bitcoin is still down significantly, 44% over the past 12 months. Ethereum even more, 68% down from its August 2025 all-time high of roughly $4,950. Likely also due to all the macro events that are still happening in the world, clearly with lots of geopolitical tensions and war everywhere. But interestingly, both assets rose also a bit after the Fed has held its rates steady on the decision on July 29th and July 30th, so at the end of the month. And one other piece that we also always look into is the ETF flows, inflows and outflows. And the July's Bitcoin ETF saw some little inflows now, roughly 200 million on a net basis over the course of this month, following significant outflows in May and June. So a bit of a stabilization here. However, also here, comparing it to the peak from the 150 billion in September in 2025, we are now with Bitcoin ETFs assets under management at around 78 billion. So roughly half of the value was lost over the last 10 months. And with Ethereum, it also looks even more dramatic. Roughly one third of the peak of the assets under management are still in the ETF sector, focusing on Ethereum. So current assets under management are roughly 10 billion of the peak of the 30 billion that were placed in ETFs that we saw in August 2025. So still not a big recovery in the crypto space, but rather continued a trend downwards, or at least over July, stable with Bitcoin. And some market news here that also led to this performance is a strategy really selling Bitcoin again. And strategy, we're always obviously talking about MicroStrategy, that sold now 3,500 Bitcoin for roughly 260 million at the end of July, or ultimately throughout July. And this followed a small symbolic 32 Bitcoin sale late in May. We already reported on that in the last news episode at the end of the May. That was ultimately Strategy's first sale since 2022. And obviously the mantra of and never selling Bitcoin was now here again broken, which obviously was taken up by the media and criticized here of those that really follow Strategy's position. This was really the first break from its never sell mantra. It is small in size, but clearly big symbolically. Both sales together total less than 0.5% of all the total holdings of MicroStrategy, but nevertheless, clearly a big symbol. And last but not least, as already mentioned, the Ethereum Foundation laid off roughly 20% of its staff. So 54 jobs were cut. In June, Vitalik Buterin said that also a budget cut of 40% will follow, so significant changes in the Ethereum Foundation, which drove lots of the development over the last years. Major personnel left the Ethereum Foundation, the co-executive and nine other senior staff, some even long-time employees that were there more than 7 years. This is clearly a change in the development of the Ethereum ecosystem. And then, interestingly enough, before the cuts, five former senior Ethereum Foundation researchers launched ETH Labs, which is an independent R&D backed by two of the largest publicly traded ETH treasury companies, Bitmine and Sharplink. Joe Lubin also joined, and a custody specialist from Anchorage, and a few others. And they state their mission to make Ethereum the settlement layer of the global economy. So now, obviously, the question comes up, how does that compete to the Ethereum Foundation? So interesting developments in the Ethereum space as well, combined with the continued downward trend in price. I think that's it for the overall market overview. I don't know, Nadine and Michi, if you want to add anything on those two assets before we then continue.
Yeah, so I think you can see it with Ethereum. I think this is not an only case here. I have conversations with multiple blockchain ecosystems, especially the ones who are more focused on niche topics, that they're all struggling. I feel like it's a natural evolution of getting more profitable or pivoting even. You can see it also with the so-called RWA chains, who are now switching to focus on AI and say we will be the chain of the agentic economy. So I think there's a survival fight for some of these chains. And I think Ethereum, compared to the others, still sort of say number one in terms of volume. But I think even them, they are recognizing they have to change and they have to optimize themselves. And the move to institutions is also what I see looking everybody on, because institutions are still working and building and not getting affected so much by everything which happened this year compared to startups or protocols.
And for me, really two reactions. And thanks, Manuel, for your excellent market overview. Yeah, one is the ETF complex losing half its value in 10 months while the product itself works flawlessly tells me that there's a conviction or narrative problem. It's not necessarily a wrapper problem of the tokens. So institutions had the on-ramp now and still walked away. To me, this is a bit concerning. On Strategy, selling below your own cost basis to service preferred dividends really turns Strategy from a never sell thesis into a leveraged fund with obligations. Yeah, so the golden shine is away. The Michael Saylor as the religious leader of Bitcoin maximalists is really gone. This is now a leveraged fund with obligations, nothing more. The golden shine is gone. Yeah, 0.5% of holdings, but the narrative really break matters more than the size here. And the Ethereum Foundation split is probably the healthiest thing that happened to ETH all year. So it's now Lean Foundation, which guards the protocol values, and price aligned outsiders ship the growth of Ethereum. Yeah, so at least the incentives are finally legible at Ethereum now, which I really appreciate.
And thanks for the additional note also on the price of the sale of Strategy that is below its own average price. I think this is also as you say, an important, let's say, rational shift away from narratives to never sell. I mean, if you hold in your balance sheet assets that don't perform well and you have to liquidate them because you want to, in this case, fund preferred dividends, obviously also as a signal to the market that the company is still healthy, I suppose, then that's what you eventually have to do, right? So this is, I think, where market dynamics and narratives clash. And here, I think he has no other chance, obviously, than doing so if the company really wants to pay those preferred dividends. Yeah, so interesting to see also the reaction of all those evangelists that still follow his narrative. I mean, if you run a company that does that, then eventually you have to sell whenever you get into the territory of struggled assets.
Yeah. Excellent. Yeah, let's now talk stablecoins, specifically new issuers, banking access and payments infrastructure. And let me start with a rather big structural shift in stablecoins this month, possibly this year. On June 30th, a consortium of over 140 firms, including Stripe, Visa, MasterCard, BlackRock, BNY Mellon, Coinbase and Adyen, formally launched their OUSD, the open US dollar stablecoin. Now, why does it matter? We have seen dozens of stablecoin launches, if not 100. I mean, we always coin this phrase of yet another stablecoin here, but this one is architecturally different. OUSD is not a product built by one company. It is an open standard. That means any compliant regulated entity can issue OUSD tokens. The protocol here defines the rules, not a single operator or not a single stablecoin issuer. So you may want to think of it less like Strip launches a stablecoin or Unity launches a stablecoin, and more like the payments industry agrees on a shared stablecoin standard. And that is actually the card network playbook applied to stablecoins. So you have competitive issuers, each bank, each fintech can issue OUSD, but they all interoperate on shared rails. Visa and MasterCard know this model extremely well, and I think that is why they are backing it by participating in it.
Yeah. And the interesting piece here, I think, for OpenUSD is also the revenue share, right? So those that distribute shall receive the revenue, which is in this case for stablecoins still the net interest income from the issuance of stablecoins, right? So ultimately, when you think about Circle issuing its own stablecoin, yes, they have an agreement with Coinbase where Coinbase receives major part of the revenue that is generated by the underlying assets. But nevertheless, usually the issuer receives it, right? And here with OpenUSD, those that distribute the stablecoin shall participate in the revenue. So quite an interesting new model.
Maybe question to you, Manuel, or Michael, as you guys are more experts in stablecoins than I am. Is this open standard compliant with European regulations and with Genius Act or worldwide?
I don't think they have landed it yet, right? So at least to my understanding, this was an announcement of 140 firms ultimately supporting it.
Okay.
Whether they will participate in issuance or whether they only distribute and under which regulatory regime this will be issued, I don't think this has landed yet. But certainly something to follow, and we will here in this podcast, obviously.
Yeah, very good question. I think that explains why for us in Europe this is relevant. It is relevant for us in Europe because OUSD will almost certainly seek MiCA compliance for a euro denominated variant, and this is then the kind of infrastructure that if it gains traction, and that's always the big if with yet another stablecoin, it could then set the rails for digital trade settlement globally. I mean, it is 140 firms, including massive powerhouse financial institutions. Yeah. And given the size and the potential success, it raises an interesting question. That is why, who will OUSD actually threaten more, Tether or Circle? My take is that it is primarily aimed at Circle's institutional market. Tether serves a very specific function in emerging markets and offshore trading. It is the dollar of last resort in places where you cannot get a bank account or a US dollar denominated bank account. Open US dollar is going after the corporate treasury market, cross-border B2B payments, the fintech stack, and that is really Circle's territory. So I hope alarm bells are red and loud at Circle.
And on that note, I mean, I can very much recommend listening to one of the latest episodes of our podcast with Joey Garcia and Jonathan Knoll and Jonas, where they have already also analyzed the parallel to ultimately Libra or Diem, because it feels a bit like a Libra moment here, right? 140 companies coming together trying to issue or distribute a stablecoin, or aiming to distribute a stablecoin. So very interesting, and obviously with all those huge names, an extremely interesting project to follow. Let's see where it lands.
But maybe also to add here, we had similar, let's say, projects also in the past, which also end up nothing, right? Or if you think about back, R3 caught up with like over 40 banks participating, didn't go anywhere. Now they are barely, you know, surviving. And I think it always looks nice, but the question is really, who's the big driver behind of that? And do you have, so to say, really like then a bigger advantage using that over, for instance, established brand like Circle, for instance. And I'm also curious to see how much loyalty those brands have. Does it have an impact? Or because usually those stablecoin users, I would maybe assume that they're very idealistic. So the question is, do they move to one where they simply say, oh, it looks better, or there are bigger names behind of it? Or do they say like, no, I stick here because I trust this company for so many years and I'm happy how it is?
Yeah, totally fair. I mean, the particularly the consortia-driven stablecoins are a big question mark. We don't know if and where Kivalis will land. We don't know about this OUSD consortium. Yeah, I mean, they are promising, but they have to walk the talk, and they need to capture a share of the very competitive stablecoin market. Yes. All right, staying with Circle for a moment, because they had quite a month, two big moves that are actually complementary. First, Standard Chartered became the first global systemically important bank, so HSIP, to offer direct integrated USDC minting and redemption to its institutional clients. That is a big deal, because until now, if you were an institution wanting to work with USDC, you either went to Circle directly or used a crypto-native custodian like Fireblocks or Anchorage. Now you can do it through your existing banking relationship with Standard Chartered. So that's the same compliance framework, the same reporting, the same KYC, just with USDC as the output of your banking relationship with Standard Chartered. And then second, still staying at Circle, Circle received its final OCC approval to operate as a national trust bank. This means Circle can hold its own reserves without relying on third-party banks. It can custody assets in its own name. It becomes a regulated financial institution in its own right. And now take those two together. Yeah? Circle is simultaneously becoming more like a bank, that is, its Standard Chartered USDC access, and integrating more deeply into existing banks, that's the or its OCC charter. So their Circle is not really choosing one path. They are running both tracks. They want to be the infrastructure others built on, but they also want to have sovereign control of their own balance sheet. Yeah,
I think those two news should not be underestimated, and the relevance should not be understated. First of all, I think the on-ramp through GSIPs is an important step that the stablecoin industry actually also still has to take, right? Because if corporates, for example, if we think about stablecoin payments use cases that corporates, for example, also want to use or shall use stablecoins, where do corporates sit and which interfaces do they usually use? Well, banking interfaces, and they are customers of banks where they hold their money, right? So this is a gatekeeping institution that stablecoins also need to integrate in. So offering efficient on-ramping into a stablecoin through a GSIP, I think, and actually through all banks, is a very, very important step in the trajectory of making stablecoins a relevant and traditional way of clearing payments, right? So I think that is an important thing, and I suppose we're going to see many of those announcements over the next months and years, because Circle clearly understands that and wants to integrate in all of the different banks. And the other one is Yeah, whereas Circle really becomes more independent and also receives likely access to payment system, traditional payment systems, that also makes it a eligible participant in the traditional world and traditional payment systems, where it can then automate on itself also bridge between stablecoin rails and the traditional rails. So quite significant news, definitely.
Yeah, and from a monetary theory perspective, which is one we at the podcast really enjoy adopting, what Circle is doing here is fascinating because they are building what I would call a para-banking entity. It looks like a bank, it acts like a bank for certain functions, but it is not funded by traditional deposits. It is funded by the demand for USDC itself. So, I mean, you may want to call these deposits, but I mean, I would refer to deposits as the traditional banking deposits the whole world population just puts into traditional corporate banks. So the reserve backing of USDC is the actual funding model here. So yeah, let's keep on our radar if this parabanking model is promising. Yeah, but super interesting news. Yeah. And then moving to the broader payments landscape, to stablecoins really as payments utilities. And this is where I think July 2026 marks an interesting point. We now have UBS successfully executing its first real-world stablecoin payments. So we are talking about the second G-SIP here by now, a Swiss G-SIP in that case. One of the world's largest wealth managers is now moving real money on stablecoin rails. At the same time, we have Visa, which is beta testing a stablecoin platform specifically for fintech. So it's not just using stablecoins internally, it's building infrastructure for others to integrate. And Visa, together with MiniPay, launched a stablecoin debit card in emerging markets, taking stablecoins to the point of sale for consumers in Africa and Southeast Asia. Then you have Ramp, the corporate expense management platform, rolling out stablecoin accounts to their 70,000 plus business clients. These businesses can now pay vendors in USDC or USDT and earn about 3% on their balances. So taking them together and stepping back and looking at what is happening, stablecoins are no longer primarily a trading instrument. They are becoming the payments layer for corporate treasury and B2B commerce. The use case has shifted from crypto on-ramp to faster, cheaper settlement for business.
I think this is where they want to land, right? And we see now the first steps into this direction. I would be a bit more cautious, but nevertheless, the trend is there. I totally agree. And I think the proof of concept that UBS has done with Merge is quite interesting as well, because in this case, so what Merge also does is they connect local instant payment rails in all of the different countries to their stablecoin orchestration service, ultimately leading to a stablecoin sandwich model, right? Where For example, if you had, similar to how Standard Chartered now has built it with USDC, an on-ramp capability in a bank, you can then very easily offer on-ramping for your corporate clients. Then the stablecoin is transferred to Merge, and then Merge connects the last mile with local instant payment rails, right? So ultimately, moving from an account via a stablecoin to another bank account. And eventually in the future, no wallet address is actually being shared by any corporate here in this scenario, right? But rather a bank would choose to clear specific corridors with a stablecoin clearance if there is a new payment offering around, you know, instant real-time cross-border 24/7 payments. And this is where Merge then comes into play, because it connects those local instant rails to stablecoin flows. So it rather sits on top of, you know, any traditional banking rails and on existing stablecoins, basically, usually working with Circle. And this was now showcased here also with UBS. It's undisclosed what the role of UBS was, whether they also on-ramped or whether they simply sent some funds to Merge and merged it the rest with the stablecoin. But nevertheless, it's certainly a step into the direction of further using stablecoins in traditional cross-border payments.
Also, maybe to add here, I think it's so impressive that all the stablecoin news this year, it's getting more and more boring in regard, not that these cases are boring itself, but it's there. we are discussing now, okay, now you can use it here, now you can do that. So more and more use cases where you can actually use it. I met also people just recently who are like, oh, I don't even own fiat anymore because I'm like a nomad. I live like here and there. And for me, it's so much easier to just take my wallet and have it not in a bank, because then I have to basically move it everywhere I'm moving. And it's directly feeding into the next news part when it comes to tokenization. And I think it's interesting compared to the last 2 years where we are nowadays regarding the developments in stablecoins.
Interesting friends, Nadine. You should introduce me to your friends and acquaintances. I want to meet these people. All right. And then the final piece, very shortly, of the stablecoin cluster. The Bank of England publishing its stablecoin policy statement. This is the BOE saying, we see systemic stablecoins as part of our mandate. And here is how we intend to supervise them. So the UK is now creating an explicit dual-track regulatory model. The FCA handles crypto assets broadly, and the Bank of England handles stable coins that reach systemic scale. Of course, that's a matter of national definition of what a systemic stablecoin is, and that's one of the most debated points in MiCA, for example. What is systemic scale? What is the threshold after which a stablecoin is systemic? Yeah. So, meaning if you grow large enough as a stablecoin issuer, you graduate to central bank oversight in the UK. And from our European perspective, this is worth watching because the UK is now arguably ahead of the European Union on stablecoin-specific operational framework. So MiCA covers stablecoins, yes, but really the prudential supervision model in the EU is still maturing. The UK has committed to a specific institutional architecture for this. Yeah, but that's my take only. Happy to discuss this one.
Not much to add. I think it's needed that also the UK really lands a stablecoin regulation, which so far doesn't exist, right? And they've had definitely different ways to look at it, with all the reserve requirements in central bank money, for example, that is quite unique. And I think they've been now gradually moving towards alignment with global regulation, which is always helpful, right? Because you don't want very specific national jurisdiction requirements and specific regulations in each of the different jurisdictions, because you want harmonized regulation in order also to overcome this multi-issuance problem and so forth, right? So I think it's a good step and a good progress that they're making in the UK as well. All right, then if there's no other comments, I think we can continue also with the next cluster, which I'm taking over here and going to lead on tokenization and institutional capital markets on blockchain. And there have been quite some significant news and updates on tokenized deposits this month and cross-border payments, where we saw announcements from JP Morgan Kinexys now adding 5 new APEC currencies on the Kinexys blockchain deposit account infrastructure, which is basically their own private blockchain, right? We then saw announcement of the Swift Ledger. This was announced last year on Sibos, and obviously the industry is following very, very closely what Swift aims to do with their own ledger. There was an announcement that a pilot will take place with 17 banks. Then there was an announcement of Project Agora that the real value testing was complete, where also 28 institutions and ultimately, I think, 5 central banks participated, and some other news around the Kari network in the US. But let's start maybe with JP Morgan Kinexys. 5 new currencies, AUD, so Australian dollars, Hong Kong dollars, Japanese yen, Chinese renminbi as well, and Singapore dollar joined the US dollar, euro, and GBP flows and accounts that are now also represented on Kinexys. And they also mentioned that 4 trillion in cumulative volume have been cleared on Kinexys, roughly 7 billion a day on average. So it is continuing to be adopted, this new infrastructure. And what is it again? And it used to be called Onyx for those that followed it closely, right? Was rebranded to November 2024 to Kinexys. It is ultimately a new account record keeping system that is run on blockchains, or in this case here on their own blockchain on Kinexys. And this is to overcome ultimately downtimes of the payments processing systems that were used around the world. And now additional currencies are offered. JP Morgan also offers FX now. That was not mentioned that these currencies can also be used with on-chain FX. But yeah, it is certainly a different project than this JP Morgan coin, which is now live on Coinbase, right? Even though, and we can also include that in the show notes, I looked at the smart contract on Base, where you can see that there's not really a lot of volume. So 1 million is outstanding, 2 holders, 48 transfers in total, and 160 days ago, the last transactions took place. But nevertheless, this is the other project that JP Morgan has, right? Which is, I think, still evolving. We're talking here about the, let's say, BDA infrastructure, how they now term it. So quite an interesting enhancement, but very much focused on traditional payments on traditional accounts. Yeah. Yeah, that was one big news. And then the other one was the announcement of the Swift Ledger as set. 17 banks will pilot. Swift has developed from a concept in roughly 9 months to a plan to do the first live transactions now before Cybos. 70 banks, 6 continents lined up. So ANZ is involved, BNP Paribas, BNY, Citi, DBS, but also HSBC, Lloyds, MUFG, Standard Chartered, UBS, so significant names. What Swift plans to do with the ledger is that they ultimately introduce an orchestration layer and also record the interbank liabilities that emerge from payments between those banks that participate here. Yeah. So those interbank liabilities are recorded. What do I mean by that? So basically, an IOU of the sender bank to the beneficiary bank is recorded on the blockchain. So think about a transaction at the debtor bank where they would debit the client account, but then credit a liability against the beneficiary bank. So ultimately, it's just saying, I still owe you money, right? And the beneficiary bank would then, on the basis of that, have a claim, obviously, against the sender bank and credit the client account already. And the result is this interbank credit, or these bilateral nostrils, you could also say, and that is recorded on the Swift ledger. Yeah, and the aim here is to overcome RTGS closing hours and therefore to enable 24/7 movements also on weekends and overnights before final settlement then still happens in existing RTGS systems. So real-time gross settlement systems, which is those systems of central banks that is used to pay between the different banks. Quite interesting. What you need is a bank-centric blockchain network or a bank-centric blockchain ledger, similar to what JP Morgan has built with Kinexys. So only a handful banks obviously have that in production yet. But yeah, Swift then basically sits on top of these tokenized deposit platforms of each of the different banks.
Yeah, so Manu, Kinexys, shortly back to it, at $7 billion a day across 8 currencies, that's really production grade. That's the production grade we all want, and it pays into Nadine's statement on it's getting boring because it's production grade. JP Morgan dollar on Base with 2 holders and no activity in 5 months, that's a press release. JP Morgan really knows which of these two tracks works. So if you compare Kinexys and JP Morgan Dollar, now they know which one works. It'll be interesting to see which path they further invest into. Yeah. But the Swift announcement is the one I find really more structurally interesting. It's 17 banks, 6 continents, and Swift explicitly not issuing tokens, but sitting above bank-issued deposits as the interbank liability ledger. So it feels like Swift is saying we do not need to become the blockchain. We just need to be the reconciliation layer between everyone else's blockchain. So it's the same role they already play today, but it's new plumbing underneath. And if that model scales, individual bank tokenized deposit projects become really more like local implementations, and Swift becomes the global netting layer. And that's why I find it structurally interesting. Yeah. So That's exactly what Swift has always been playing, and they are preserving that position by absorbing the new technology rather than being disrupted by it. That's really a smart move, I think.
Totally. And you can also see that tokenized deposits, when you look in the whole tokenization space, is, so to say, the ones with the biggest volume right now happening. I think it's also interesting with the first news of JP Morgan, Kinaxis, and so on, that they also plan to launch on Canton. And I think for everyone who's wondering where the volume on Canton is coming from, it's definitely not because tokenized assets have a lot of, there are a lot of issuances and a lot of investors. It's really just a tokenized deposit transaction business there. And I think Swift positioning themselves very right that they said, okay, we are focusing on what we're doing best, but better, right? And there is, we also mentioned UK and the regulation movement and stablecoins. I think UK is doing very interesting stuff in general, also for tokenized assets recently. I'm not sure if you've seen also the launch from Bailey Gifford, who launched the first natively issued tokenized bond on a chain. They are launched on Ethereum and Solana, and the book of record is this chain. So there is no wrapper, there is no real life assets, so to say. They are the first. I think it's very, very impressive how they did it. And they got also a lot of backing from the regulator in UK and also from the asset manager Bailey Gifford himself too, which I think is impressive considering how old they are. And I'm sometimes wondering if they're really aware how pioneering it is what they are doing there. But tokenized deposit is definitely one of the biggest cases right now. Also very boring, as you said, because it's, you know, it's just using the efficiency you get there. But when you look on the tokenized asset side, of course, there's still a lot to do. It's comparable with stablecoins, I don't know, like 2 years ago.
Yeah, I agree. The whole space is still developing, and it's interesting that Swift has now really landed with a particular blueprint. I'm a bit skeptical that this can really scale, right? Because ultimately what you do is you record bilateral interbank liabilities and claims, which is hard to scale. And usually you also don't do that, right? You do settlement between major banks in RTGS via Target 2, for example, straight away settled cross, and you don't record interbank liabilities. So it will be interesting to follow the continuous announcements over the next months and maybe even years, because what I understand is that this is going to be a first test, but not eventually not the final end state of how they design it, right? So we'll definitely keep an eye on that. The other major project that was announced that had done its real value testing was Project Agora, and it works a bit differently, right? Because what they do is they also bring central banks on the table to allow ultimately correspondent banking that is usually done via SWIFT, which also where SWIFT connects central banks for settlement. Here, in this case, the BIS and the IIF, the International Institute of Finance, brings central banks on the table. So in this case here, Bank of England, Bank of France for the Euro system, Bank of Japan, Bank of Korea, and the Swiss National Bank participated in this real value testing. It's a bit of a similar blueprint like the regulated liability network for those that are long-term listeners or have followed over the last years, all those multi-bank tokenized deposit platforms, right? And obviously we've been talking a lot about Agora anyhow. So major banks, 28 institutions, BNP Paribas, BNY, Citi, Deutsche Bank, Eurex, JP Morgan, Lloyds, Mizuho, MUFG, SMBC, Standard Chartered, UBS, major names, they all participated, and roughly 800,000 Swiss francs converted into Swiss francs were processed in 17 different scenarios, including PVP, corporate and interbank settlement, single and dual currency payments, and roughly it took 80 seconds for every settlement, which is quite fast, even without RTGS and core banking integration, right? So in this case, also no integration was yet done, but rather the existing payments processing was still at the core of those transactions, but then also connecting and representing everything on the blockchain that was provided by a tech provider called Kaleido, which is a major tech provider in the TradFi space, right? So quite interesting and definitely a big project in the industry at the moment, which is even combining central banks, and therefore you don't necessarily have to record interbank liabilities, similar to how SWIFT does it, but rather settle straight away, similar to how at the moment also settlements between major settlement banks happen in central bank money. Right? And then last but not least, another announcement I'm going to, looking at the time, speed up a bit, is the CARI network, which is a consortium of community banks in the US. 30 plus have already joined, and 40 more are apparently in talks to join. The pipeline represents more than $10 trillion in combined assets in all of these different banks. I'm not aware of the names of those banks, given that I'm not based in the US. So First Horizon, Huntington, KeyBank, M&T, Old National, South State, those are roughly the bigger banks, or the namely the bigger banks in this consortium. They launch, or they aim to launch later this year, and the announcement is really that they now scale up and bring additional banks to the table. They build on Providium, which is a layer 2 of Ethereum, right? And the interesting piece is all the different banks will issue tokens on the same layer 2 instance, right? So there's no Huntington chain or no MT chain that is then connected, similar to how Swift Ledger, for example, does that. And there's also apparently one unified token, which is indistinguishable between the different banks. And here's what I, where I say I don't get it, right? I don't know how it works. So I think we should certainly, when they continue to communicate about their set up or then also go live and invite somebody from the CARI network, because ultimately, clearly, if it's still a deposit, it will be a liability of each of the different banks. But here, for some reason, or they say it should not be distinguishable between the banks. So definitely also an interesting project from all the smaller, or relatively smaller community banks in the US, also focusing on tokenized deposits. Those were the major news on tokenized deposits. And then last but not least, also two very interesting and significant news around tokenized securities. And I think, Nadine, this is also your home turf, obviously, here, where you clearly also have views, I suppose. DTCC have now successfully converted their first assets that are held in the depository trust company into tokens that were then issued on a Hyperledger Besu platform, so a private network of DTCC, but also on Canton. And they aim to launch their service for production in October this year. This was really just a dress rehearsal, you could say. But 30 plus firms have already participated, and major firms like BlackRock, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, NASDAQ, the New York Stock Exchange, Vanguard, Circle, as well as a stablecoin issuer, Chainlink, State Streak, and SocGen, and others. And they tested a couple of different use cases: collateral pledges, securities lending, treasury and repo delivery versus payment, and equity delivery versus payment, and several others. So quite a significant move, and obviously, the industry is watching very, very closely when DTCC moves, assets move on scale, because this is the central securities depository in the US, and this is the only one, right? So if they move, the whole industry moves. So definitely a big update here.
Yeah, so what should I say? DTCC, I love what they're doing. It's amazing. I mean, they already did something smaller but similar already last year, I think in fall, where you could watch a video where they were doing those live tests and you could really see the different use cases and why and how it works and where it fails and where it can, you know, be recovered, whatever they're doing. And this year it was like even bigger. And now you could say, okay, it's maybe just for the outside. But I personally know that they are building a lot in the background. If my memory is correct, I think they will have big announcement in September, October-ish, where they will basically come out. And I think also why it takes also longer than maybe, especially if you're considering that they already did something last year, there were some internal shifts. I think it was for them very challenging to basically define what the strategy long-term will be, and then who are the right people on the right position. So there was a lot of team movements. They split now also departments. I think they split tech from development and it's very interesting how they are moving. And yeah, very excited for September, October. I hope, fingers crossed. It will be also interesting to see the chains. I think they will not stay on Bezo and Canton. I think I heard also other ones, and who will be involved. And also, of course, but we will talk also about that, the regulatory environment in the US, how this will affect every initiative around that. Will be interesting to watch. But yeah, big moves.
For sure. And yeah, in Europe, we have several different CSDs that need to move, right? And hopefully also accordingly in a harmonized way. Let's see whether that happens or whether new entrants like Ceturion and so forth really also can capture parts of the CSD business on blockchains. Here in the US, DTCC is the only one that exists. And so if they move, really the market moves. So quite interesting. But what we've also seen here as a big announcement in Europe is Clearstream, which is the post-trade infrastructure from Deutsche Börse. This one of the CSDs, Clearstream D7, which is their electronic securities platform, but they also have their blockchain platform. They have now issued their first DLT native commercial paper. So 77 million was issued 10 business days. It was the duration of the commercial paper. Citi was the sole dealer and the issuing and paying agent ultimately, and investors were, for example, Deckerbank, DZ Bank, Eurex, Union, interestingly also the Volksbank Mittlerer Schwarzwald, so a very small community bank in Germany. Yeah, it was a very much first ever transaction because it was a same day follow through that Decker and Eurex mobilized the commercial paper at the Bundesbank as collateral via the Clearstream tri-party arrangement. And this is only possible because the ECB has very recently ruled DLT-native CSD securities that they are Eurosystem collateral eligible. And this was a missing piece, obviously, right? Because all those tokenized bonds and tokenized securities that you saw were not eligible for being used as collateral for open market operations within the Eurosystem, for example, for repos. And here, this was now done. So definitely a primer and a first-time transaction. So congratulations on those that were involved. Yeah, so lots of developments in this space. Looking at the time, I think we need to speed a bit up. That was already a good discussion. Handing over, Michi, to you again for additional updates on the regulation policy and CBDCs.
Exactly. So now we cover the regulatory and legislative landscape from the EU digital euro advancing through parliament to the US Clarity Act debate and big MiCA enforcement in Europe. So let's start with Europe. The EU Parliament Committee greenlighted the digital euro bill. Members of parliament are now ready to enter the trilogue negotiations, that is the formal process where Parliament, Council and Commission negotiate the final text then. So this has been a long time coming, really. The legislative framework for the digital euro has been in discussion for over 2 years now. And I think what is remarkable is how the ECB's framing has shifted during that period. ECB executive board member Cipollone explicitly argued this month that the digital euro will, quote unquote, shield banks from stablecoin encroachment. Yeah, let that sink. The ECB is no longer selling the digital euro primarily as a consumer convenience for a financial inclusion tool. The core argument is now about monetary sovereignty, keeping European payments infrastructure under European control rather than ceding it to private US dollar stablecoins. And frankly, when you look at what happened in our stablecoin cluster, OpenUSD launching with 140 American firms, Circle getting a US bank charter, Visa building stablecoin rails, you can understand why the ECB feels urgency here. If you are a European policymaker and you see dollar stablecoins becoming the default settlement layer for global commerce, Manu talked of the Libra, of the second Diem moment. You really have a potential sovereignty problem, definitely a sovereignty risk here at hand. Yeah. So the contested points in the trilogue will be holding limits, how much digital euro can individuals actually hold, and offline functionality. But the direction of travel is now clear. The legislation will pass in some form after the trilogue.
Yeah, that's the missing piece, obviously, right? The trilogue. So we're going to follow that very closely. But what I hear from the industry and from those that are even closer to the political developments is that it seems that there's a bit of a boredom now on this topic. And then everyone just wants to, you know, finalize it and get it over the edge. So let's see how quickly it will take. I feel like everyone just wants to go ahead now and have it final, and then the real work starts, which is the implementation at each of the different banks and payment service providers. Yeah, so it's going to be a massive project over the next years for all European banks and PSPs.
All right, let's now jump to the other side of the Atlantic, to the US. And this is where things get both politically fascinating and somewhat absurd. So let me tell you the JP Morgan Clarity story, because it perfectly illustrates the state of crypto discourse in America right now. So Altcoin Daily, an account with 2.3 million followers on X, posted, "Just in, JP Morgan backs Crypto Clarity Act." So all caps, maximum hype here. The tweet went to about 200,000 views, 3,000 likes, hundreds of retweets, except it was completely fabricated. The evidence was a screenshot of a blog post by two JP Morgan executives, except that blog post never mentioned the Clarity Act, not once. I did not mention legislation. It did not mention legislation, a bill or Congress. What it actually said was quite the opposite. Payments innovation becomes dangerous when it drifts into shadow banking, offering yield-like incentives without the capital, liquidity, and consumer protection standards that accompany traditional deposit products. End of quote. That's it. So that is JP Morgan expressing deep skepticism about stablecoin yield, which is one of the core features the Clarity Act would enable. So the tweet got the story 180 degrees wrong. And as one of the time we are recording, no correction has been issued, at least to my understanding. So why do I spend so much time on this? Because it matters for how legislation actually gets shaped. When millions of people believe JP Morgan supports Clarity, that creates political pressure. Misinformation at this scale has real policy consequences. Yeah, and meanwhile, in actual regulatory developments, the SEC is signaling it will propose regulation crypto, a comprehensive framework, rather than continuing the enforcement-only approach of the Gensler era. And Senator Wyden is pushing to keep developer protections in the Clarity Act. So the bill still faces major timeline pressure before congressional recess.
Maybe also some background information here. I mean, our company is headquartered in the US since last year, and this gave us the opportunity to go to the Hill and talk to, I think we talked to over 12 or 13 senators on the Republican side and Democrat side. I even talked to the crypto task force in the Eisenhower building next to the White House, which was, by the way, a very cool meeting. And to see how policy shaping is being done and how everything is affecting this bill is on the one hand side shocking, but it's also quite fascinating. I mean, some people say, oh, it's because of this, and this is the reason why it takes so long, or this is the reason, but actually it's a lot of different reasons who come together, which causes the delay. And one of the really, really big ones is basically the war in Iran, which is keeping everybody so busy that there's not enough floor time for them to sit down and to discuss and to vote. So this is one of their biggest issues, that there's not enough floor time And I think it's only like 4 or 5 Democrats votes which are missing to get this bill across. So it's very, very close, but there is simply no time. And then there were like some people were fired from the Hill. So when you rehire people, you have to also vote again. So it's also taking another floor time. So it was crazy. And you have senators who are like champions who really want to go it through. So for instance, Cynthia Lummis is the most famous woman in this picture. She is, I think, retiring very soon. And for her, it was a big mission to get this bill through the line before she basically finishes her career. And I think she said like that her whole career, this Clarity Act is like her most painful Sisyphus task she ever had. And yeah, we will see. I mean, we have only August, then the midterms are coming closer. There is not, then there is really no floor time anymore. Trump came into the picture, I think, way too late because he was so busy with other things that he couldn't really push on this topic. He now started to push again in the last few weeks because he noticed, okay, it's not progressing, but it looks like it is not helping, even though he signed the ethics, I don't know the English word, passage, because of course a lot of the Trump family got critics that they earned a lot of money in crypto, and there were ethics questions around how a politician can use their position to you know, leverage on that. He signed it, but it looks like it didn't change at least the opinion of those missing Democrat votes. My informational source is saying it's not coming, unfortunately. They don't see it. And it's coming from senators personally. So maybe there is a miracle. I will hope it, because the market needs the structure. We need orientation. And the US market is really missing, especially when it comes to tokenized assets and liquidity. It's excluded everywhere. But I think they are the innovation drivers. It's often not Europe and not Asia. So fingers crossed, I will not give up.
And I assume all those crypto players, or also the traditional finance players that are now heavily investing into this technology, are really expecting that regulatory clarity will emerge. We'll follow closely, obviously, over the last months of this year. Well, ultimately, still we have a few, but let's see whether we make progress here. Looking at the time, should head on also to last few updates, and I'm going to keep it very brief. There were also quite interesting announcements and actions in the crypto ecosystem and platforms. So, for example, Robinhood chain went live on July 1st. This is an Ethereum layer 2 built on Arbitrum. It's live since the beginning of this month. It offers 24/7 trading of tokenized US stocks across 120 plus countries, right? So it's a global offering. Quite an interesting move, rather a retail move, obviously, for Robinhood clients that can now also trade, for example, on the weekends. And interestingly, I mean, you nowadays have to tick those boxes. It explicitly framed as an AI native way to trade securities. So it's designed for AI agents to trade and not just retail humans, so to say. So quite an interesting pitch. Interesting is also the revenue share. So 10% of net protocol fees are routed back to Arbitrum, which is ultimately the infrastructure on which it is built. And also 8% going to the token holder controlled treasury of Arbitrum here. Yeah. So interesting move, certainly, where there's also options and futures on crypto being announced by Robinhood. Then another news was also around crypto, that Morgan Stanley on their E-Trade platform, which is ultimately a self-directed retail brokerage arm, now also offers crypto spot trading. And why do we include this? Because most banks still don't offer direct access to crypto. Clearly, you can buy, for example, OTCs or ETFs, right? Sorry, not OTCs. Exchange-traded products, OTPs, right? So, for example, exchange-traded commodities, like we have here in Germany as well, or also in the US, the Bitcoin ETF, for example. But here in this case, it's really crypto spot around Bitcoin, Ethereum, and Solana, and they partner with Zero Hash. Quite an interesting offering. We still see major banks entering the space, offering direct access to crypto. And then last but not least, also two additional updates on stablecoins. And we briefly touched earlier that Visa also now launches its stablecoin platform, which is focusing on FIs and fintechs, ultimately to help to issue stablecoins. And they also mentioned that they want to focus on OpenUSD, which we have already covered in the beginning quite extensively, right? Where also a new wallet as a service offering comes in, plus the minting and burning connectivity for OpenUSD. So this basically complements the existing stablecoin offering around their stablecoin settlement proposition, the stablecoin link cards that they issue, and money movements. And then last but not least, also Crédit Agricole becomes now active as a stablecoin issuer. EuroXT is issued via the Caixa Bank, which was acquired back in June 2025. And Caixa also already has a CASP license from the French regulator, so it is a regulated crypto asset service provider. And Crédit Agricole issues via Caixa this one-to-one MiCA compliant stablecoin. The reserves are exclusively held in cash only at the Caixa Bank's balance sheet. It is an interesting move because it was directly used for settlement of a tokenized Amundi money market fund, so rather a capital markets use case here. But yeah, as our dear listeners know, and those that follow the euro stablecoin industry very closely, it's still negligible, right? And major players like Circle are dominating the euro market or the euro stablecoin market cap, 730 million euro C and outstanding. Sorry, 450 euro C, million euro C outstanding of the 730 million overall market cap. So still less than a billion market cap of euro stablecoins, with 61% being euro C. And then, for example, 20% with 150 million, the convertible euro CV from SocGen. And now Crédit Agricole also joining this game. Yeah, so obviously we'll follow also closely the stablecoin market in Europe in general, but then also this particular stablecoin.
Lovely. Thank you, Manu. You did an excellent job in giving the overview of the more crypto asset related news in the space. And I would say with that, we have a pretty extensive overview of what happened in July of 2026. And as every month, we gonna present to you the most promising or worthwhile knowledge bites that you can read through or listen to or watch to educate yourself about crypto. What I brought is an IMF note titled "How Agentic AI Will Reshape Payments" by the two IMF co-authors Sonja Davidovic and Herve Turp. By the way, our next episode will be exactly about this paper, so this is shameless advertisement. We're going to interview Sonja Davidovic to kick off a deeper investigation of agentic payments at BFRR in general. And the paper itself is really two IMF authors asking an emerging question in payments infrastructure, that is, what happens when AI agents start initiating transactions autonomously? No human pressing confirm. So this idea has massive implications on payments infrastructure, and we're going to double click on these in the next episode. Enjoy reading.
And I already know that I'm looking very much forward to this, because that is a very interesting topic that obviously the industry is talking a lot about. What I brought with me is, are two papers actually on the same topic, which is the ECNY 2.0, so the Chinese digital yuan that ultimately turned from a retail CBDC project that the world has been following quite closely whenever there was any public announcements in English that can that were able to be read, or also those that were issued in Chinese that were translated. But that has turned from a retail CBDC into deposits provided by banks. So a significant shift. The retail CBDC project of the Chinese PBOC doesn't seem to exist in the way it existed before any longer. It was designed as a liability of the central bank, obviously, as a retail CBDC. It was intended to primarily be used as a substitute for cash in domestic retail payments. It has never been really formally issued, but PBOC has done several tests over the last year since 2020. But now they decided three changes. It was reclassified from cash to deposits, so bank liabilities ultimately. They integrated into the classical reserve requirement system, where banks hold reserves at the central bank and provide liabilities itself and allow it to bear interest. So we will hyperlink both articles, one research report and also one from CIG Online in the show notes. It's extremely worthwhile to read, and eventually we'll also dive deeper on the whole topic in this podcast as well over the next weeks.
Great, and I brought two articles. If you have a little bit less time, but you want to read something very interesting, there is in tokenized assets definitely a token supply overhang, so to say. There are more assets than allocators at the moment. They're coming. And these two articles are basically giving good insights into what they're interested in terms of asset classes, product structures, and so on. So one article is written by the Tokenized Asset Coalition and friend of mine, Adam Bloomberg. He has founded a crypto RIA, registered investment advisory in the US. And he gives insights into why they would love to invest, but they can't because of the nature, how these assets are currently structured and what he would wish the issuers will change so he can actually provide those investment opportunities to his LPs. The other article is from Arrakis. It's an European-based startup. And they wrote a really great article or research piece around the investor landscape. So who are the investors, what they're investing in, and they give like a good roundup in terms of numbers. The status quo, yeah, love that. Would love to see more research about that. And yeah, leave it here.
Love it. Thank you, Nadine. Oh my goodness, five pieces to read. That's quite an ask from our audience or to our audience. But so you choose certainly worthwhile knowledge bites to educate yourself. Yeah, and with that, let me say thank you for listening to Bitcoin, Fiat, and Rock and Roll and for making it until the end of this comprehensive news episode. Thank you to Nadine in particular, and Manuel for your takes and insights, super precious. So if you allow some calls to you guys, if you enjoy the podcast, please recommend and rate us. That always helps us the most. And do connect with us on YouTube, LinkedIn, and our expert community on Telegram, both in German and English, where I hope you're going to find Nadine too. If not, Nadine, this is your time to join the community. Visit our website and make sure to subscribe to BFRR wherever you get your podcasts. Until then, this is Bitcoin, Fiat, and Rock and Roll. See you next week in another episode when we'll be exploring another critical development, that is agentic payments. Don't forget, we bring Europe's perspective on digital money and digital assets to the world. That's our mission, and it's great you are with us on this mission.
Thanks both.
Talk Thank soon. You, Cheers. Guys. Cheers.
The views expressed are solely the personal opinions of the hosts and are provided for informational purposes only. This podcast does not offer financial or investment advice. Always conduct your own research and make well-informed decisions before investing. Please be aware that the hosts and guests may hold cryptocurrencies or digital assets discussed in this episode.